It's Wednesday, October 10th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 73 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is John.
My name is Adam.
Why do I have to go last?
Because you're stupid.
And your name is not Adam. I'm Adam. You're Luke.
We have two other guests.
And Three other guests.
Another regular host.
Let's start with the regular host, so go ahead.
This is already going poorly.
Don't be bashful. Come on, Tex.
And my name is Tex.
There we go. And then also, we've got two guest hosts with us, if you guys would like to introduce yourselves.
My name is Ryan.
And my name is Tim White.
And Tim White, you'll recognize as Tim White off the forums. Ryan is, in fact, Ryan Dancy, who we've had on the show before. And we have gone from one extreme to the other. We've gone from having three hosts for a couple episodes to now we have, seven, because Tex finally got his Skype working. It took us a while to get this one going because Tex couldn't get Skype working. But now we have seven hosts. And we're going to talk about a couple things in this episode, but one of the big things we're talking about, and the reason that Ryan and Tim White are joining us, is this is a rebuttal to the episode we recorded at Gen Con, where we and a couple listeners roundly thrashed organized play. They're here to offer an
Gen Con episode.
Yes, that one, not the other one.
Not the other one. Okay.
Yeah, rebutting that episode would take on a completely different meaning. But we are here to offer a juxtaposition to that episode. So
campaign rules are pushed back another week.
Much to my disappointment.
All of our disappointments.
We lied to you last week when we talked about having campaign rules.
Yeah, my disappointment is partially assuaged by the fact that Ryan and Tim are here. That makes me happy. And Tex, too.
Yes.
It's been a long time.
We've got our own show held in contempt now. We've lied. And we are not doing the campaign rules. We will do those next episode.
It's a damn shame we don't have a contest to win.
Just this came up pretty quickly,
we
so we're going to go with this.
Reform.
All right, three quick announcements. And as I said last episode, we are not going to explain these announcements in great detail. If you want to know more, go to the show notes. There will be links there to forum posts that will explain things in greater detail. So the three quick bullet points is, first of all, Worldwide Wing Night 3 coming up on November 10th. If you like beer and wings, check that link out. The second thing is our Eve Guild is doing surprisingly well. So
it's because I'm awesome.
Expectedly well.
And now I'm on. I've been playing Halo 3 and I gave that up for Eve. Who would have thought?
In fact, I believe the majority of the people on the mics right now play Eve. So if you're looking to sign up on Eve, follow the link there off the show notes.
Too long, long hair.
And the last one is the Spoof Podcast Contest is still running. So once again, follow that link if you need contest details. All right, with that out of the way, let's get straight into the content. Ryan, you said you had a comment on something we said in last episode about the relationship between the number of modules and the success of a particular RPG.
Yeah, well, as you know, I listened to Fear the Boot for my own name to be mentioned. So when you said that I probably was screaming in the microphone, you were exactly right. I think that there's one game out there which you could look at that was very successful and until very recently has essentially no scenario content support, and that's the Palladium Risk game. It's the third best-selling role-playing game of all time, and there may be a half dozen published adventures for that product.
People bought Rifts?
Apparently a lot of them did.
Wow. A bunch of my friends from college cut their teeth on Rifts as opposed to AD&D, and they all said the same thing. We love the idea. We hate the system, so we just kind of work our way around it.
Yeah, there's a lot of background material in the Rifts games that you could probably use with any gaming system that you wanted to use it with.
That's because Rifts has everything imaginable in that setting. It is literally a kitchen sink and everything else.
Yeah, Rifts was D20 before there was a D20.
I know a lot of people who buy Rifts. Hey, I don't know people to play Rifts.
Don't tell Kevin CMBA to that. He'll punch you in the face.
Kevin and I are actually pretty good friends. I've said that to his face, and he agrees with me.
Oh, well, good for him. All right, cool then. So
punch you in the face. He'll agree with you.
Yeah.
did you have more on the modules, or was it just the comment about Rifts?
My comment basically is just that I don't think you can necessarily look at the successful role-playing game and say it's either successful or not successful because it has module support.
You know, Ryan, it seems to me that you're not just agreeing blindly with me and John.
Well, you know,
that's a questionable life call.
Well, let me give you a little bit of background on some research we did at Wizards of the Coast. One of the things that we talked
research?
About...
Research? Whoa! We don't deal with facts on Fear the Boot, okay?
I know, we just state them, and then that makes them true.
What you were saying, Ryan?
One of the things we talked about a lot at Wizards was the difference between games that need episodic story content, like modules, and games people play because they want to play the basic story that is the property. And the two obvious examples are D&D, which is a game that you play episodic story content in. There is no story of Dungeons & Dragons. It's whatever story the characters want to play, and or the players want to play. And the other side of that coin is Lord of the Rings, where most people, if they had their preferences, would play the story of the Fellowship of the Ring. So one
really?
Of those products has to have a lot of scenario support, and one of them doesn't have to have any scenario support.
Huh. Is that why the Decipher version of Lord of the Rings failed?
You know, I don't even want to begin to comment on why the Decipher version of Lord of the Rings game failed.
Please elaborate. I'm sure I'm curious, and I know a lot
they
of listeners
are. They were so drunk off the success of Decipher Star Wars cards that they didn't have any energy left.
I do love those Decipher Star Wars
Hey, cards. Decipher Lord of the Rings card game was fun. The role-playing game had promise and then immediately went into the toilet.
Oh, they looked at the card game and said it could be worse. Where's cool.
Ryan,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
This is, I have no comment.
This, oh, come on.
This is why we do a podcast and not role-playing radio. Okay, so with that out of the way, let's get into the next topic, the main topic for this episode, which is a rebuttal of sorts to what we said about organized play on the Gen Con episode.
What you guys said. Play.
Yeah, I was not. You there. Have agreed with off mic, so
that's fair. I said it on mic. I'll
I did not
it.
Agree with everything. I am the outlier here in the Fear the Boot host
we'll
category.
Get there.
Notice and he called himself a liar. So let's. How do you guys want to handle this? Do you guys want to start offering a case? Do you want me to offer the negative side and you guys rebut that? I'm gonna set this up as a real slow pitch softball to Tim and Ryan. How do you guys want to take this?
Yeah, I think you should start by restating your argument.
All right, let me start with the first argument, which for me is one of the biggest killers. I don't like the idea of gaming with people that I don't know.
Okay.
Okay. You want rebuttal to that, or?
Yeah, if you've got one.
Okay. Well.
Yes, you do.
Yes, I do. I absolutely do.
Yeah, so when Ryan's done, I'll rebut as well.
Okay.
Okay. There were a couple of key findings in the market research that we did before we did third edition, and some of those are public and some of those are not. But this is one of the public ones. The number one reason that people stop playing a hobby game that they wish they could keep playing is they can't find anybody to play the game with. Not because they got too old, not because their preferences changed, not because they matured and went on to some other kind of role-playing, but because they can't find anybody else to play it with. So organized play for role-playing games is primarily designed to create an environment where that problem can be solved, where you can always find somebody to play the game with. So then if you still choose to not keep playing, then you're going to have other reasons. But at least the first reason is going to be addressed.
Tim?
So my biggest opinion is that when you play with the people that you know, you guys have brought this up over and over again on the show, you fall into very familiar patterns. You fall into, well, Mike's always going to play this character, Tim's always going to play this character. No matter what game you're playing, and it takes a real effort of will to break out of that. And one of the things that I found after years of especially competitive role-playing is that it really forces you to broaden your horizons as the type of characters you play, the interactions you have with people, not to mention giving you a chance to try before you buy. You get to sit down and play an event with someone for 4 hours, and if they're the most obnoxious, horrible person in the, you know, in the world, you exercise what I call the Spectrevision rule, which is, I think I'd rather go up to the room and watch Spectrevision than continue to play this game. Whereas if you invite someone to your house to play a game, there's a lot more commitment. You might be playing for a longer period of time. And it gives you a great chance to try out different people before you buy. And at the end of the game, you're like, you know, I had a great time. We're looking for a couple more players for our group. Would you like to join us?
Missouri has a castle law now that solves that problem. Anyone I bring into my house is on a non-committal basis.
You know, the non-Missouri listeners probably don't get that.
Yeah, no. I know. Probably well, no, all. Castle Doctor actually started in another state, so there's people in some states.
Dude, is that from Frank Castle and the Punisher?
No. It's from the British common law that a man's house is his castle.
Yeah.
It's not, it has nothing to
That's
do with
That's not
Frank
nearly
castle.
As entertaining to
no.
the community. If, come on, if, you throw me a bone.
See, right. I've played it many an RPGA game day with people I don't like as I sit at the table and find the person beside me continues to talk in my ear for hours and hours, ignoring the GM, just talking about his character. That's the RPGA to me.
you know what? Let's talk about the converse to that case, which
okay.
is I played in a whole lot of RPG games, people I never met before, and I had a great time. And I met people that share my hobby and that were interesting, passionate people to meet and to talk to. Some of them became pretty good friends. And, you know, it's kind of artificial that you get put into a situation with people you don't know. But sometimes artificial situation is the only way to get to know people you don't know.
You hit the big point there, because I've found people I like, too. And shared is the key word. The shared experience of the RPGA is the key to it all. That is something that just doesn't happen these days. When D&D first came out and everybody played through the same modules, everybody had a shared experience. Exactly. And the same thing goes for the RPGA, but it is unique now compared to the rest of the role-playing industry in general.
I have to throw out as sort of a concession to this side of the argument that my own experiences have made me somewhat bitter. That we have talked about many times that part of the reason we started this show is because we were under the impression that the vast majority of people out there did not play role-playing games the way that we did. Because, Ryan, you mentioned that when you guys were out there looking for hack and slash players, you couldn't find them. Believe me, I could introduce you to dozens of them. That is all I've had contact with through most of my gaming life. That when I went to my game stores, I went to conventions, I went everywhere, everywhere I went, all I could run into was generally very immature players who did not want to get that deep into the role-playing. Quite frankly, without taking this into a 20-minute rant, ran some very, very sad games. And this really has embittered me on playing with strangers. Now, I have to say, in all fairness, though, that as I've gone out and done Fear the Boot, and obviously people listen to the podcast, or people at least generally agree with us, because if they didn't, they'd probably turn us off. So I'm finding as I get out there and do Fear the Boot that we are not alone. There are people out there who share our views, who are really neat individuals, who are really good at running or playing games. And
exactly. And there's no way to meet them unless you go out and give it a try.
Right. And part of giving it a try is taking that risk that you may have to sort through a stack of idiots to find a couple really cool people that
you have to kiss some frogs to find a real prince. Right, Dan?
Thanks, John.
Yeah.
I will defend the RPGA and say that I think you'll meet a few dogs in the process of meeting a whole wealth of really great people.
And one of the things I'll say about the RPGA organized play and even the organization in Colorado that I founded that does work like this is that the quality that you get from an organized institution that is at least trying to put some level of quality around the events that are written and that takes a look at reports of bad GMs and that sort of thing, at least at some level, really does raise that quality level above Bob the high school guy running his, all rape all the time campaign at the game store.
I don't know.
I missed that one in the Archon program.
I don't know. Phil is GM qualified in the RPGA.
My personal experience is more around wargaming, but I've had similar experiences to what you guys are describing in that you're going to meet a lot of people, and you're going to meet a small group of people that are really great that you might end up gaming with on a routine basis. You're going to meet a small number of people that you just can't stand and never want to see again. But the vast majority of the people I met, I kind of had neutral experiences with. I didn't really hate gaming with them, but it wasn't someone I'd really care to seek out again either. But like you say, you can't win if you don't play. And so I think there's still value, even with my wargaming experience, to going out and competing in tournaments or something. Because that's why I dropped out of Starfleet Battles and Warhammer, is I just didn't have anybody to play with.
Yep.
Let me throw out my biggest argument for organized play in favor of. When I was in optometry school, my last year was all rotations. I spent 8 weeks in Kansas City, which was a fantastic RPGA community. We had a lot of people who were very excited. We had a guy named Andy who hosted AndyCon once a month at his house, had like 30 people over, 4 or 5 tables worth of stuff. There was always a game to be played. There was always food. It was just a great social experience. And after that, I went to Australia for 8 weeks. Australia, which is fantastic, and I go back in a heartbeat, but seemed like a world away, which it kind of, I guess, is. But when I went down there, guess what? My RPGA character, the one I'd built up at AndyCon, still worked down in Australia. I found a game day down there right away and could jump into games and play and meet some good people down there because it's a universal experience. It's a universal campaign worldwide. I had a character that worked and that fit in. And I still have the meta org for that, even though I haven't played in about 2 years.
Let's talk about that, because there's something you said right there, and Tim kind of went down this road. And so this takes me to my second argument against organized play, which is that because of the fact that you are having to standardize gameplay, the modules themselves become rather dry, uncustomized to the characters, not all that deep, that I could write if I sat down and wrote a custom campaign with these characters in mind, that I could write something that's much deeper, much more vivid, much more flexible than the forced connect-the-dots, paint-by-numbers packet that's required by an RPGA event in order to make sure that people don't end up with things they shouldn't end up with or have results they shouldn't end up with or whatever the case is. And this is a complaint I've heard from a lot of people played in the RPGA, that the games themselves were entirely too wooden. How would you guys respond to that?
I have so many comments about that. I could probably fill
this
podcast.
Yeah, me too.
I'll try and limit myself. There are a lot more professionals writing source books and writing long-form adventures than there are writing scenarios for a four-hour time block at the RPGA. And having written a bunch of those scenarios, I can tell you it is a completely different art form than writing a 96-page source book or a 64 to 32-page long-form adventure scenario. It is one of the most complex tasks a RPG writer can do to create a fun and exciting experience with a beginning, a middle, and an end, given that four-hour time block limitation. Which is not to say it can't be done, it just means that a lot fewer professionals have tried their hands at it, and so the state-of-the-art is much less developed than it is for other kinds of role-playing game products. All of that said, there are some amazing scenarios in the RPGA library, and if you played them, you would say, I can't believe they did all that in 4 hours. The reason there aren't more of those kind of scenarios is it's so hard to write them.
Well, I think Luke can rebut that from his own experience at Gen Con. I mean, for example, when we were demoing Skies of Glass at Gen Con, or not Luke,
Chris.
I was not at Gen Con.
Chris, that's right. I'm sorry, Chris. I apologize.
I felt you there, Luke.
So, to Obocop, I apologize. So when Obocop was demoing Skies of Glass at Gen Con, he ran a four-hour scenario three times with three different groups of people and had three extremely different experiences.
Absolutely.
So even though it was the same scenario, it worked out differently. So I don't think that would necessarily mean it would have to be wooden, even if it's a short, canned experience.
I think the bottom line comes down to what every game comes down to, which is who is at the table. You can take a mediocre scenario with boring characters and have an awesome GM and have an amazing experience. And you can have an amazing scenario with horrible characters and a horrible GM and still have a pretty mediocre experience. But the bottom line is that there's nowhere else where if you want to play four or five games of D&D in a week, every week, forever, just about, the libraries are that big these days, at least in the Living Greyhawk world, there's nowhere else to go do that. Now, that may not be everyone's cup of tea, and it's certainly not my cup of tea anymore. I mean, I enjoy a completely different experience. But you guys talk about Archon and the kinds of stuff there, the cons we have in Colorado. We run 3 4-hour slots a day, every day for 3 days of gaming and nothing but gaming. And there are people who sit down with a level one character on Friday night and walk away, you know, level seven on Sunday night and are super happy.
Let me come about that a bit. Because my experience has been, even if I play with the same group of guys, people I know, people I like, and people I like to game with the RPGA, some modules, especially the ones that are in the core modules, some are just terrible. I don't know how they get in there. There are some really, really bad adventures. I remember one, it was you go through a jungle, you get to a temple, you find a 2-room dungeon, and then you leave and are chased by a hydra. And it was ridiculous. There was no climax. It was terribly paced. Yep. But the flip side of that is that there are a few really good authors in there. Joe Selby, who ran Divers here in Missouri for 2 years, just wrote a phenomenal series of modules that, the story was great. The pacing was great. The guy understood the system. He understood the players and he understood the region. And you really felt like you were contributing to something when you played. But there are so many modules that don't take that into account, that because there are so many different play styles and anybody can author, that you get a bunch of crap in the system.
And I think another way to combat this is that when I was first starting to play, everybody played only at conventions because it was a competitive thing. It was scored. It was, you know, under supervision of judges, that kind of thing. But as the living side of games started to take over, more and more people played at home with their home group. They might have 10 or 15 people, and it's a drop-in, drop-out, whoever shows up that week. And that DM can take the game and customize it for that group, even if the module's bad, even if it's not very customized. They have that just like the module conversation you guys had last episode. And they can do that because they're running it in a much less formal environment.
Also, I think one of the things you're going to see happen with the D&D online tools, and I'm totally speculating here, I don't have any insider knowledge, they're going to add a reputation economy to the RPGA. You're going to have the ability to vote on the quality of scenarios and on the quality of game masters. And as time progresses, the quality scenarios with the high votes are going to bubble to the top, and people are going to be able to find them more easily than they can find them right now.
I hope you're right, because that would be fantastic, because there are a few authors out there who continually put out crap. And we're published in Dungeon, and we're published in the RPGA.
Well, you saw what that got Dungeon.
Yeah, exactly. But we played him, and we're like, who is this guy? Why does he get to publish this stuff? Because he does not seem to understand what D&D is about, and yet he continuously gets published about stuff.
Well, the living campaigns all suffer from the same problem that the massive multiplayer games suffer from, in that there is a small cadre of players who will play all of the content that's produced. And if there is a period of time that goes by or no new content is available, those players who tend to be very vocal and very public make their unhappiness known. So there's this pressure on the system to constantly be adding content to the scenario library, and that pressure, unfortunately, sometimes overwhelms the quality filter.
Absolutely, especially on a local level when everybody's a volunteer.
Oh, yeah, 98% of the scenarios, probably 99% of the scenarios in the scenario library are written by volunteers.
Exactly.
My problem was more that the regional adventures were always fun. The core adventures were always crap because the core was so diluted down because it went through three or four committees and you might have had a bad author to start with. So it was always a bad experience. It was the worst parts of D&D put into format on the table for somebody to run.
There's a perverse disincentive in work in Living Greyhawk, in that the regional triads and the geographical regions of the game have had the emphasis placed on making their regions really cool and really interesting. And so there's a tendency that if you have a local author that's really good and writes really good scenarios, you don't want that content put in the core. You want that content to be localized and kept in your region. And I think that tends to filter out the best writers.
And that's completely my experience, because the local adventures were phenomenal. We had some great stuff. Again, one author keeps coming to mind, Joe Selby. He was fantastic, and he really took the region to new heights. And everybody loved the stuff he wrote, except for a few naysayers who had personal biases against him for this reason or that. Which is, again, one of the problems with RPGA is the politics, is that people who might have more experience writing or getting published will say, oh, this up-and-comer, he's nobody, he's nothing, and get stomped down.
Well, I think the politics is a matter of, if you take all of the politics of your normal gaming group, things like this person didn't show up this week, or this person doesn't like that person, and you expand it to the number of people that we're talking about and the size of region we're talking about, it's really not surprising. You know, it's just the same politics on a macro scale.
You know what? You nailed there, Tim. That's a fantastic observation. I agree with that completely.
And, you know, you can either deal with it or you can't. And it really got kind of bad for me after a while, because the living campaign aspect of the RPGA, again, as opposed to kind of what I grew up with, really turned it into a very much a consumer-oriented economy where, as Ryan said, I want more modules. You're not giving me the content. I'm paying my, you know, RPGA dues or whatever, and I'm not getting the kind of content that I need. I'm going to quit the game. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that if you don't give me more content. Whereas previously, it really was, holy crack, you've given us this amazing experience. You know, it was really a wonderful thing, and it's very gratifying as an author to do, you know, a scenario where you write a three-round scenario for something like Gen Con and thousands of people play it and write you and say, wow, I had such a great time, whatever else. It's really a huge incentive to write. Whereas I found that as it started to become a living thing, I would start getting these emails like, you know what, the treasure in room 23 really jacked my character. I only use a giant glaive and you gave me a dagger. Where's the giant glaive for my character? Can't you write a module with a giant glaive? So it really kind of completely changed the attitude of people from a very volunteer-oriented, play experience-driven thing, much more like a kind of a Savage Worlds Burning Wheel feel, even though it was D&D, to very much more of an MMO feel at the tabletop.
And that's what I find that the living experience is. It really does feel like an MMO at the tabletop, because the thing you have most is the shared experience. You have the stories of the stuff that you did and other groups did, and you can talk about how you did it and how you accomplished it and what your characters did, even though it's all the same thing in the same game world. You know, one group doesn't change the world. It's every group changing the world at the same time.
Right.
And you know, for 20 years or so, the RPGA has been the only professionally funded and kind of run organization, although there's a lot of not corporate organized play role-playing game organizations out there, the RPGA is really the only one that's ever had money spent on it. And they got as far as they could get with a couple of staffers and a big group of volunteers and email and, you know, face-to-face meetings at Gen Con. They took it about as far as they could take it. $1 billion is being spent on developing MMOs right now. And the problems of MMOs are the same problems of living campaigns. But now a whole lot of money is being spent to make the experience of playing an MMO more fun and to get more of those story elements and those character elements in the games and do a better job customizing that scenario on the fly so that it makes sense for the players to be in those games. And my hope is that a lot of that understanding and that technology will trickle down to the RPGA and to other organizations like it and start to improve that experience on the tabletop, just like it's improving that experience at the computer.
And see, I've heard the exact opposite from people who are heavily involved in the higher levels of the RPGA, is that WotC was continually trying to shut them down, even though they were selling the new source books, because every time something would come out, they'd give new options for players, and new players would start with new stuff. So people would buy books. But they would continually try to shut down the RPGA in various and sundry ways, but they couldn't do it because there was such a fan base. And now with 4E is kind of their chance to take back over and take the D&D Adventures and make it big, and take Living Greyhawk and make it not as big or different than it was. Because
two questions about that. One, and this is where, Ryan, I'm hoping you can add some insight. Is that true? Was WotC really peeved by the RPGA for some reason? And two, if so, why?
Okay, Wizards of the Coast is not unhappy with the RPGA. If anything, Wizards of the Coast is amazed that the RPGA exists and functions and works. One of the things that you don't see from the player side, but we saw from the publisher side, and I saw this when I was running Living City, is a source book that comes out, and a character that could get a min-max benefit from something in that source book, that player goes nuts trying to get that thing added to the game.
Oh, hell yeah.
And that thing may not have been very well play-tested, and it may have been designed to operate with all the rest of that source book material in play at the same time. And if you don't bring that whole source book into the game, that one thing becomes very unbalanced and very unstable. And the process for testing things for use in a living campaign is so much more complex than the process for testing it on a tabletop game, where a DM seeing things could go wrong could just say, you know what, that doesn't work that way anymore. But in a massively multiplayer tabletop game like Living City or Living Greyhawk, once you put something in the environment, it's very difficult to go back and change it. So the pace at which new content can be added to those games is significantly slower than the pace at which it can be published. And that always creates distance between the outside RPGA participants and the inside publishers who are looking at that material.
See, that might be the truth, but I know from locally, from various groups, you know, 30, 40 players hanging out at various cons and talking, is the feel was that WotC was trying to shut the Living Greyhawk down because there was so much in the hands of volunteers and players and not in WotC themselves.
Now,
and that's why D&D Adventures came out.
They definitely wanted to pull that control back.
I think that's, I have to disagree. I think that's mostly a conspiracy theory. It's not backed up by truth.
Well,
that's not surprising.
If you interview an individual random person at Wizards, you might get somebody to say that was true. But if you got all the way up to the level of, like, Ian Richards, who runs the RPGA, or to the brand managers of the D&D group, I don't think they would say that. I think they might say they were unhappy about the directions that certain regions of the campaign took, and they tried to get it under control. But I don't think they ever said, we got to get these volunteers out of here and centralize this thing back.
See, and that, I agree. That's comforting to hear. That's good.
Ryan already pointed out that there's some similarities there with user-created content in video games. And I'm very, very eager to see if what he kind of foretold comes true, and that there's some sort of codified or formulaic way to introduce new content in a way that wouldn't be terribly unbalanced. I mean, in our beloved Battletech, for example, there's mech design rules, but because the mech's construction rules are codified, you could make a completely new mech and know it wouldn't be terribly unbalanced.
Hey, Tex, there's always Dark Age, man.
The reason it's not unbalanced Mech Warrior is because the stock mechs cheat.
They don't follow
those rules.
Yeah, they do.
So you'll never be as good as the stock mechs.
Yeah, because they take quarter tons and they round differently and,
double heat sinks.
But
sorry, I'll contain my 1980s outbursts.
but where I was going with that is perhaps could there be a codified set of rules? So, for example, if you wanted to introduce a magic weapon into the role-playing game, that there would be a limit to how many pluses and minuses it could have, or some sort of a framework
there,
for which
there really is.
Yeah, there really there is.
Yeah,
there's a shackle.
You've got such huge flexibility at the tabletop. That's one of the beautiful things about the tabletop. You've got this amazing flexibility. And that means that, as Ryan said, everything is so complicated in terms of interactions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you could easily have, in fact, we were preparing to introduce some of these things in the Living City before we shut it down. Let me digress very quickly. In the Living campaigns, there used to be things called certs, which were certificated items. When an item became persistent and it existed outside of a scenario, you had a piece of paper that said what that item was and what that item did and who owned that item. And those items could be traded and they could be sold between players. And from time to time, they could be cashed in for various upgrades within the campaign itself. But there were these paper records that represented these persistent objects in the game. And you talked before about the character, the player complaining about the fact that he got a magic dagger and he really wanted something else. The obvious solution to that is to have a cert that basically says, this cert is for an item of check one, dagger, sword, mm-hmm. spear, bow, and you just exactly. pick it right there at the tabletop. That way, the item that you get makes sense for your character. The pushback on that is players at the table don't like the fact that they just fought the ogre chieftain who used a sword to kill them, and the treasure is a bow.
Exactly.
See, not surprisingly, that's my experience, is that, you know, when you beat a module, you have an option of things to do. You know, even though you kill the ogre with the bow, if you're the ranger who wants the bow, you don't get that bow unless you pay for it, which on a tabletop level sounds ridiculous. You know, okay, I beat him, why can't I take his bow? But when you're looking at the worldwide campaign aspect and balance of it, it makes sense, because not everybody who might beat that chieftain can afford the bow and probably shouldn't deserve it.
So,
and
I mean, D&D D20, which I will separate from other role-playing games, which I'm not familiar enough to make this argument, Core Dungeons and Dragons has very good rules about how many pluses an item can have and how you stack the bonuses and the various magical effects. It's relatively easy to add a new magical effect option into the library of things can be put into the game. It's pretty easy to test, and it's pretty easy to figure out if it's going to break something. And that kind of thing is reasonably easy to do. What's hard to do is add prestige classes, new kinds of character action, feats. Things like that are so likely to have connections to other things in the game that you could combine to make a what we would call a degenerate combination, something that was simply superior to all other options, that they just have to be treated like radioactive material. You have to put it in a lead box and look at it for a bunch of time to make sure it's okay before you touch it.
Well, what do you feel about, so switching the subject a bit here, okay, WotC has Living Greyhawk, it has D&D Adventures, it had a bunch more Living campaigns, Living City, for instance, and Living Rokugan.
Yeah.
Stuff run by fans. Living Rokugan now is run by a bunch of guys who were down in either Springfield or Raleigh, I don't remember, but who still, like two or three guys, still run a Living campaign, even though that WotC said, no, we're done with that, and still consistently publish modules and still consistently run at cons. Is that something you think is viable? You know, the fan-based effort?
Yeah,
well, it's viable for them.
Yeah, the question is how big can it be scaled up to?
Right.
I think that all conspiracy theories aside, I think Wizards did make a conscious decision to reduce the number of officially supported RPGA campaign settings. I think they did. I think that they decided that it would be better to take the time and effort they were spending in whatever level of monitoring they felt they had to do for those campaigns and reduce it to just a handful.
Is that a lesson they may have learned from the twilight of second edition when there were so many campaign settings that they buried one another?
I can't tell you if it is or isn't, because I wasn't there when that decision was made, but it seems like the logical extension of that understanding. Yeah. Yeah.
I agree.
I believe, I'm not certain about this, I think I heard this at Gen Con, I think they're ending Living Greyhawk too.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. They are.
That's actually on my list of things to talk about, so we'll come back to that. Let me get to my third objection to the Living campaigns or organized play. Objection number three is the lack of continuity. That, yes, I can take a character and plop him down into any module, but there is no sense of continuity in the terms of, like, if I play with my friends, we can have a long ongoing campaign where it's not just the character, this one character may persist. We have a group of characters that persist, or an overarching storyline that persists. Whereas in here, it's just kind of, I'm sitting down with a group of strangers, maybe a different group of strangers every week, and we are doing a module that's completely unrelated to the previous module. And to me personally, and I would think to a lot of players, at least from some of the conversations we had at Gen Con, that destroys an important element of the RPG. How would you guys respond to that?
I think that experience is completely fixable, and is within, to some degree, the ability of the existing system to address. It doesn't get addressed because people are more interested in writing a scenario based on a cool idea they had rather than trying to follow up on a long-running campaign thread that they might not find interesting.
The regional Living Greyhawk system, though, I believe really lent itself to an author writing a 7 or 8 module series that really did have a big arc. And I know that in our region here in the Mountain States, we had numerous people write modules that had interconnections and cross threads, and they would take stories from the tables of particularly amazing actions for characters or whatever and weave those into the backstory of the next module. And that really is, as Ryan said, totally fixable and doable depending on who's writing the modules.
Yeah, Tim, you nailed it there. You know, my personal experience is that the regional adventures tell a very good story and something that people can interact with that through large interactives or even through, just like you said, amazing play. The Triad hears that. The authors who get assigned stuff saying, hey, include this fact from this story because this is what happened. And the authors who write the regional play tend to write things, you know, 9 or 10 modules in a line that tell a story. Tim said the regional play, I think, completely fixes that. Core play, that's a huge problem. Regional good, core play bad.
Let me put on the publisher hat for a minute and talk about the other half.
What's that hat look like?
It's blue. It's got a Seattle Mariners logo on it. And
is there a feather?
No.
How big are your boobs?
Let's say an author makes a 10-episode scenario arc, and somebody comes in on episode 7 and says, mm-hmm. I just found this campaign. This is what I want to be doing with my weekend. What am I doing? And their option is to play the 7th part of the 10-part series, and they didn't play parts 1 through 6. And it's assumed that they know that the ogre chieftain is afraid of water, and it's assumed that they know that the cleric back in town is really a vampire, and it's assumed that they know that the holy symbol of the god of peace and justice is whatever. There's so many assumptions that you can build into one of those arcs that it becomes impenetrable for a new player. So you have to really be careful to balance the ability to come in the middle of a story arc versus the interest of the players that are in that story arc to be rewarded for having paid attention earlier.
I agree, that's fixable by the players that you're playing with, because I know lots of people are like, oh, you didn't get to play the first 3? Well, let me give you the story, you know.
Along those lines, this kind of slides right into my concern number 4, which is the lack of anchoring of the character into the world. And what I mean by that is if I'm playing a game sitting around with a bunch of my friends, and in this particular game, I make a friend or enemy out of a particular person, or I have a brother that's written into the background of my characters in town that I can get certain things from. And this is all, let's say, balanced and reasonable. It's not some game-breaking mechanic. It's just the relationships that develop naturally between the PCs and NPCs over the course of the game. And now I pick my character up, and like Luke, I fly down to Australia for several weeks and plop down. This character really, okay, he gets to bring his certed items with him, and he gets to bring his levels with him. But really, the actual human element of this character and the social interactions he has have now completely disappeared into thin air. And as someone who's very interested in the character development and human aspect of a role-playing game, that seems very disappointing to me. And is there an obvious fix to that?
Yeah, you certificate the relationship. There's no reason you can have a cert that says, I have a brother who's an innkeeper, and this is his inn, and these are the resources that are at that inn.
But legalized relationships?
Yeah, I mean, would the game master, I mean, if I say, look, I want you to cert that I made friends with this cleric, I mean, is the system in place where he would write that up and I could walk away with that?
My answer to you is today that probably can't be done, but there's no reason it couldn't be. It just hasn't.
There are exactly certs like that in Living Greyhawk today. If you finish this module and you gain the respect of so-and-so NPC, there will be a cert saying, you are good friends with so-and-so NPC, and you can take that into your next module.
Now, are those limited, or could you potentially get into contradictory certifications? Like, if two groups had different experiences, could you get a contradictory cert from the two groups?
Well, then you're
Emperor Palpatine. You can do that.
But you can't play the same module twice, so you can't have the same character with a contradictory cert from the same guy in the same module.
No,
so
but let's say player A plays a game and player B plays a separate game, and then at a later date they come together and play a game together, and they bring contradictory certifications from the two
previous
games.
Absolutely, and the NPC is like, I hate you and I love you, go away. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the role-playing starts.
Now, all that said, I have to say, you know, my preferred sort of organized convention event where the characters are provided to you. The story is written around those characters. The characters have extensive backstories. You're coming in at the prime of their lives. It's the distilled essence of adventure gaming where you're playing characters that have essentially been adventuring for a long time and that they're at the pinnacle of their careers, and you come in just boom at the perfect sweet spot moment of their lives and play a more film cinematic sort of moment of their lives, as opposed to a living campaign, which is much more of an episodic TV sort of thing with maybe a seasonal arc here and there. So my preference, of course, is to have the characters pre-built to the scenario so that all that stuff is interwoven. But I have seen it done with good players and good DMs in the living way as well, where it comes out quite nice.
Yeah, you know, I really like your analogy there, and I wanted to pick up on a little bit that I was listening to a lot of Dan's complaints and some of the praise from the other people, and it in many ways seemed to me like I was hearing one person likes movies, one person likes television shows, and that it's more of a difference in preference of play style than – but both of them are playing to their strengths. I mean, something that's a good television show might not make a good movie or vice versa.
And let me emphasize that the thing we're talking about here is just talking about specific story threads. If the campaign is not following a thread you like, you can petition a triad in the RPGA to do a special mission for you. It's tough to get done, but they can do it. They can do it, and I know a few people who have done it and who have run basically adventures that are specific for certain people that deal with subplots in the main storyline. And if you have a good triad, that might happen. If you don't, that's not going to happen. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, I did that quite a bit in the Living City Robert Weestays with characters here in Colorado, where we would put together special missions with a special group of characters that all knew each other and wanted to accomplish some specific thing, you know, recovering a paladin's mount or something like that.
Yeah, the other comment I want to make really quickly is that Tim is exactly right in that when we use the term organized play, that is an umbrella term. It does not mean a living campaign. If it is exactly as useful to have an organized event where the characters are provided and you play a predetermined scenario from the standpoint of being able to play a game you can't find other players with, as it is to say that there's this whole living world and there's all these persistent objects. They're both organized play. They're just different flavors of the same system.
Well, what is organized play that isn't the RPGA right now?
Well, anytime you go to a convention and see a list on the program book that says D&D adventure being played at 12 o'clock, 5 seats available, that's organized play. It's
right.
An organized event at a scheduled time with the game you are told what you're going to be playing, and you show up and play it if you want to play it.
I guess even though this may not be accurate to the term, the assumption that I was making coming into this episode is that when I say organized play, it may not be RPGA, it may not be a living campaign, but this
is more than con gaming.
Well, it's ongoing, that this is more than a one-shotter or a two-shotter at a single convention. That this is something that could go on for weeks or months or years, where you're carrying that same character from one table to the next.
Yeah, right. I will tell you that inside the industry, organized play is not used in that sense.
Well, no, right. But for the sake of this conversation, that's kind of the...
Well, but see, I want to kind of use this to expand people's knowledge and understanding of that, because in recent years, that's all that people have known, is that persistent world character sort of thing. But before that sort of took over, there was a whole lot of other kinds of organized events of role-playing at conventions and not that had completely different characteristics and appealed to a completely different group of people.
Right. I guess the reason I'm separating them is because if you walk into a convention, there's a whole series of different constraints and different contexts to that than you would get in an ongoing game, the first of which being just by time constraint alone, you can't create characters, so you're probably going to be handed one or given very narrow terms by which you create that character. And then once that con is over, that's the end of that character. You know, it's not like you're walking away with certifications and a stamped character. And
like Heroes of History coming up.
Right, and there were judges present or whatever.
You mean I can't take Speedy Ronald Reagan to
no,
my next
Speedy
D&D
Ronald
game?
Reagan is well, just in our game that we're playing on Saturday.
The Dungeons & Dragons may be unique in this, but I think you can do that with D&D characters. In the Seattle area where I'm from, there is a very active convention scene.
I hear it's rainy.
It is. Conventions run from the end of summer to the beginning of summer, so it's basically a nine-month convention season. There's usually a convention every month. And before the RPGA kind of colonized the Northwest and really brought living campaigns in, there were a lot of games that were just run, and you were told, bring a character between X and Y levels. and it was your D&D character. And it didn't matter where that character had been before, but it was going to play in that game with whoever else showed up at that table. And D&D is very portable. It still is very portable.
Right. Well, and you even saw that with Neverwinter Nights, that with the Neverwinter Nights, you had the ability, I think, to bank or store your character controlled servers to where you could bring them in and out of campaigns. And it was a way of proving that you hadn't cheated by, like, creating one room where you pull a lever and a plus five weapon drops for no particular reason. And
with a lot of wargaming, you'll say bring a 3,000-point army, or like in Starfleet Battles, they have tournament cruisers. You can pick which one you want, but you're going to bring a tournament cruiser. So you know when everybody shows up, they're going to have roughly comparable things. What? But that still gives the individual player creativity and control over what he wants to bring.
I want the Excelsior.
I want my Atlas to have a 3D6 or a Navy Colt pistol. That's what my Atlas wields.
All right.
You done?
Oh, no. Yeah, we've had too much serious talk. Tim White, what are your thoughts on breasts?
Breasts are awesome, especially your breasts when they're pointy and beer bottly.
That's Ooh. Awesome, and that will be in my profile if Dan ever posts it.
I just touched Luke's breast.
He did, and it's big because I'm fat.
If you look around our forums, Fear the Boot has the biggest nipples in podcasting.
We do.
And we have a picture of T. Morris, the man who wrote the book on podcasting, to prove that we have the biggest nipples in podcasting.
Fear the Boot does have the biggest nipples in podcasting.
Fear the Boot does love
T-Morris. Speaking of rain in Seattle, I'm going out of my mind trying to get my deck painted. I've been trying to paint my deck for the last 3 weeks, and it will not stop raining.
I painted my deck blue and black because I had a psychotog.
Actually, I don't get it.
I don't get it either.
I will say that other than Luke's amazing nipples, I do love my wife's breasts best of all, I'd say.
Oh, you suck.
Okay,
up.
Now, okay.
Sure, and just to bring it into the podcast, remember, my wife is Johnny G's cougar. So.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
So would you allow Johnny G to touch your wife's breast, though? That's a question. That's a question of the day.
As long as he wasn't holding a beer light, that's like, you know, garlic.
I'm holding a Colt 45 tall boy right now. Does that pass your moral screening?
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to work for her.
Awesome. If it's good enough for Billy D.
Hey, it's good enough for Tim. We just have to pass the actual breast bearer's approval to get Johnny to touch those boobs.
Oh, that's never been a problem.
All right, well, this may be a Gen Con 2008 event.
I don't know. Consex is dirty, dude. Not even with my best cougar would I submit to Consex.
Your best cougar in the stable.
More than one?
Yeah. No, there are more than one, actually.
You wouldn't believe.
John, I don't know what configuration I decided on character creation of life that said plus 10 bonus to cougars, but I picked it.
John has mud cougars. Dear God, mud cougars? Who plays mud these days?
I have two mud cougars. Full-time mud cougars, too. They am me all the time.
All right, couple last things on these living campaigns before we wrap this episode up. First of all, earlier someone was mentioning Living Greyhawk's ending. The thing that I have been told is that Living Greyhawk is ending in favor of starting up Living Forgotten Realms.
Right, that is true.
Yeah, what,
remembered realms.
Yeah, they're not apparently real well forgotten. What do you guys think about that? I mean, anything at all? Just change of settings?
Well, I think there's no way they could possibly keep Living Greyhawk around and convert to a completely new rule system. They've mentioned over and over again that characters cannot be translated. They'll have to be reimagined. There's no way they could keep it. And I think Ryan, more than anyone, can speak to how hard it is to bring a whole living campaign through an edition change.
So are you saying... And I know Ryan's under NDA, so we'll keep this directed at Tim, unless Ryan's not under an NDA on this particular comment, that a character from 3.0 cannot be converted into 4.0?
They have said that explicitly in public multiple times, that you will have to reimagine your character into 4.0, that a direct conversion is not possible.
You'll have to get the proper fig and all that.
They have also specifically said that no, we're not making a miniatures game. We already have one of those, and we'd like you to play both.
Yeah, and it's called 3.5.
Yeah.
All right. Look, I have two things left. One is that I wish, dear God, that we could talk about what we were talking about before the mics turned on, because Ryan had such fascinating points, and I'll tease the listeners with that. And then I'll end with, Ryan, what games do you play?
Well, hold on. Before we get... Good question. Before we get to that, I got one more on the living thing.
Okay.
Before we sidetrack completely.
Fair enough.
The direct and pointed question here, Tim and Ryan, do you guys currently play in organized play events?
Wow, that's a great question.
That silence sounds like no.
That sounds like a big no.
So let's follow up.
I absolutely do not play in living events at all anymore.
Why not?
A lot of personal bitterness, but it also has to do with, like I spoke before, that complete change of to a consumer-oriented thing. Like, we're sitting down. The DM is here to entertain us. The Triad is here to produce modules for our entertainment. You know, Caesar, bring it on. As opposed to what it was when I was growing up, which was a volunteer-driven thing where everybody was there to produce the best modules they could and really have a great experience as a shared thing.
You know, and Ryan, you probably have some insight on this, but this sounds fairly common to a lot of games in general, be they electronic or tabletop, that there's always this radical change in feel from when it's the small group having fun together where they all have some sort of a common understanding or a common goal to when you open it up to the public and suddenly everything changes.
I read every single scenario in the Living City Library, all of them. And I'm here to tell you that there was as much crap in that library as there is in the Living Greyhawk Library today.
Excellent.
So everybody remembers the good things.
That's
and
the fear of the brood way.
Oh, no. There was so many bad events in the Living City thing. Yeah.
As history passes, our memory selectively remembers the great things and ignores the horrible bad experiences. So the farther away you get from something, the cooler it usually gets in your memory and you edit the things you didn't like.
Okay. So distance equals rate times fun?
Advice is a form of nostalgia, where we dig up the past,
I'm going to kill two birds with one stone. I am not in a tabletop role-playing game campaign at the moment. All of my role-playing is currently online. I play MMOs. I play EVE and World of Warcraft and City of Heroes.
Hey, do you play EVE and World of Warcraft at the same time? Because you can do it really easily.
I probably could, but I haven't bothered. I think it's probably likely that there's going to be a new tabletop role-playing game campaign starting here in Vegas because Owen Seiler, who is the general manager of Gen Con.
Seiler? What?
Yes, exactly. So with Owen here and Christian here and me here, it would be stupid to not get into a game, so that'll probably happen. Before I left Seattle, I was in a game group with Lisa Stevens, Eric Mona, Bill Laysfield, Scaff Elias, and a few of the people from Paizo Publishing.
Jeez, Ryan, why don't you drop some names, White Rat? Holy crap!
It was probably the highest-powered D&D group I've ever been in. It's just a fun recreational group. It wasn't for business. We were just playing because we wanted to play D&D.
Now you can move from gaming industry execs to strippers.
Yeah.
I was in a group with Candy, Toddy.
Well, we certainly had some interesting experiences when we would come to a place in the rules, the rules didn't work correctly, and we would all kind of look at each other like, whose fault is this?
All better than this.
Okay, so before we wrap this up, I think we actually might have asked this in the interview, but Luke wants to know, Ryan, what games do you play personally?
He just answered that question, Dan. You don't listen, long hair, you hippie freak.
He said who he plays with.
All his hair is on top of
he answered the damn question.
He's not gaming, but on online games.
Did just answer that very question.
Well, no, but I thought we meant in general. Like, what games do you enjoy playing?
You long-haired hippie freak.
I play all kinds of games. Just got done playing Halo 3.
Woo! Yeah!
Luke's still illiterate to understand his own question.
I play a lot of card games. I play a lot of poker.
I love
that. I'll say this publicly because I've told the guys at Gen Con, I listen to Fear the Boot while I play poker. So if you're ever in Vegas and you see me at a poker table laughing and you can't figure out why, it's because I'm listening to Fear the Boot.
It's a great way to keep your poker face on because you can look angry or laugh and it'll have nothing to do with what you were just dealt.
Adam's dad and I team up against him to take all his money. And we've done this repeatedly successfully.
Yeah, that actually kind of sucks.
I wish I could have made that session.
Do you play in any living poker campaigns?
Living poker.
My money is persistent.
Isn't that Living Deadlands?
Really, my money isn't persistent. That's the kind of crap.
Your money persistently goes into my money.
You get a full house. You get a full house sorted. You get to take it with you to the next game.
Exactly. Yeah.
All his poker is sudden.
I try to read a role playing game every week. So every week I'm reading a new game.
Wow.
That's
hardcore. I read one every decade.
Okay, well then let's refine the question. You've read a lot of role playing games. What is your current favorite?
That you were not involved in.
If you could throw down and play right now, what would you grab?
I would probably play Burning Wheel because I've only played it once and I'd like to play it again.
Oh, we talked about that earlier.
I think the New World of Darkness is really, really well written.
Hells yeah, I'm for that.
I'd like to play a game of Dogs in the Vineyard. I think that's an incredibly interesting world to play in. And after reading Robin Law's blog about converting these rules for use in a political environment, I think that the girlfriend game sounds really interesting, too.
What?
I have it on here somewhere. I'm trying to remember what it's called. It's basically a game where you play a girl, and it's a relationship game, and you play characters who have social interactions with each other, and you resolve problems based on who you hate and who hates you.
Look, I have that already. It's called My Life. I don't want to play that on the table.
Yeah, it's called, like, Girl Talk or somebody Dream made, like, Telephone or whatever.
I totally have to give a shout-out to Spirit of the Century, which I think is probably the game play a game in Vegas, it's probably the game we're going to play.
I'm still stuck on the fact that somebody turned Babysitter Club into an RPG.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's really good.
I'm happy that Ryan pretty much mentioned most of the games I've mentioned since I've been on, so he and I were tight.
Yeah.
He's a giant of the industry.
Well, I am 6'6", but that's about the only giant.
Yeah, we have a picture here on the big board of everyone that's involved in this podcast holding hands, and we're all about the same height, and then there's Ryan, where we, like, come up to his waist.
Please don't spoil Halo 3 for me, because my Halo 3 just finally came out of the shrink wrap.
Master Chief makes out with Cortana twice. He gets to second base.
The game I was talking about is called Best Friends. It's by a guy named Gregor Hutton. And Robin Laws used these rules, not with girls having a feud, but with the cabinet of a presidency in the future who are deciding where to send special forces missions on covert operations.
Cool.
I like Robin Laws' work. I've only read a couple of his books, but they're good.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Yeah, you can't go wrong these days with so many RPGs being published as PDFs. It's really easy to get them and really easy to read them.
You know, on the same side, I love that a lot of great RPGs are available by PDF, but there's a lot of crap out there, too.
Well, there is. Democratization of the medium,
The buzz really helps you kind of identify things that you can at least take a look at, and the price of entry is really low now. I mean, you can go spend $15 on a PDF, read it, and go,
I agree.
I love how many great one-shot adventures are coming out now.
Oh, yeah.
For whole games, you know, Polaris and the Mountain Witch and Primetime Adventures, which is a big favorite of mine, where you can just have an amazing just night of very intense role-playing, and then you can either continue or not.
Yeah. Primetime Adventures is everything I'm against in role-playing. I'll say that right now. Kudos to the people who like it.
How do you really feel?
Kudos to the people who like it, but I am completely, that is not my style at all. And I know I'm not by myself, but I'm not with the group on this. Some people really like it, and more power to them, but not my style at all. Primetime Adventures
It takes a lot of what you talk about a player-driven game and really makes it a player-driven game.
Yeah, I like the pseudo-player-driven game with traditional elements as opposed to let's be hippies and smoke pot.
Luke. Ooh, touchy-feely.
Yeah, Luke,
all right.
To do it all half-ass.
I do. I love the half-ass. The full-ass is too much for me. I can't handle it. I can't handle it all.
Half-ass all the way.
Yep, exactly. If I have to go full-ass, I am not a full man.
Luke ruins this podcast because up until he came along, this podcast was like a bunch of old people, except instead of Matlock, we hated everything but Battletech.
Get off my lawn.
I'm sorry, I read RPG.net every day, so I know what the new stuff is, guys.
Get off my Matlock hex map. RPG.
All right. Well, on that, I think we're going to wrap this up. So thank you guys for tuning in. And thank you, Ryan and Tim, for joining us. And
glad to be here.
We will catch the rest of you next time.
Da, 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 da.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.